Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, the call to live a Christ-centered life. And marking the feast day of Saints John Fisher and Thomas More with our popular Latin lover. But first, Finland and the Holy See, 70 years on. On the evening of Monday, 18th of June, the ambassador of Finland to the Holy See, Dr. Alpo Ruusi, hosted a conference to mark celebrations for the 70th anniversary of the establishment of a full diplomatic relationship at ambassadorial level between Finland and the Holy See. The year was 1942, the exact date, 29th of March, and the Pope of the time was Pius XII. It was a year after Stalingrad, which some historians pinpoint as a psychological turning point of the Second World War. But on Monday, the venue for celebrations was a sun-bathed Finnish institute located at a high point on Rome's Janiculum Hill. Present at this conference were the Vatican's Secretary for Relations with States, Archbishop Dominique Monberti, and Finland's Minister of the Interior, Mrs. Päivi Räsänen. Representing the three official religions in Finland were their Christian leaders, the head of the majority church, the Evangelical Lutheran, Archbishop Kari Markkanen, the head of the Orthodox Church, Archbishop Leo of Karelia and all Finland, and the Catholic Bishop of Helsinki, Teemu Sippo. I spoke to them as well as to Ambassador Ruusi and filed this report, in which I begin by affording some background to this first Nordic land to engage in diplomatic relations with the Holy See. Finland, a 5.3 million strong nation, is a land of water and ice, a harsh land, where in the far north, for many weeks in winter, the sun may never rise, and in summer, the sun may never set. Harsh, too, is its history. Hundreds of years of Swedish rule were followed by a further century of Russian control. A legacy that lingers on in the memory of its people, who've displayed skill at balancing the demands of an 800-mile border with Russia. A haunting presence, the Finnish composer Sibelius famously attempted to escape from with his renowned Finlandia, glorifying in this composition his own nation in defiance of the oppressor. A musical independence foreshadowing political independence that would only come with the Russian Revolution in 1917. An independence which draws, too, from far-reaching roots of a heroic past to be found in the pages of the national epic, the Kalevala, which highlights a 2,000-year-old oral tradition, only published in 1835. An independence for a nation which, contrary to the other countries in the so-called Nordic space in the years following the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, stepped out of the Cold War shadows into the warm embrace of Europe. And earlier still, getting back to our story, exactly 70 years ago, in 1942, in a world enveloped in flames of war, it embraced diplomatic relations with the Holy See, a first once again in the Nordic space. And so to mark this historical milestone, a conference took place in Rome at the Finnish Institute, located in the Renaissance-era Villa Lante on the Janiculum Hill, with its stunning views overlooking the city. I was invited to go along and began by speaking to my host on this occasion, the Finnish ambassador to the Holy See, Dr. Alpo Ruusi. Given diplomatic relations were established during the war years and coming from a nation which has a long-standing reputation as promoter of peace, hosting as it did one of the major peace accords of our time back in 1975, as well as being an active member of the United Nations participating in peacekeeping, it came as no surprise that the conversation with this ambassador focused around peace. This is a special occasion. It's 70 years of diplomatic relations between Finland and the Holy See. What does it mean to you?
Oh, it means a lot. Finland was first Nordic country that established full diplomatic relations with Holy See. I think we were even 40 years before the other Nordics came. And I think we were also taking care of the Nordic interests in the Holy See a long time. And we learned a lot, and we learned more about international relations because the Holy See has a very strong representation throughout the world. And it was a special reason to come here during the World War II. Finland wanted desperately to get rid of the war, and we thought first that this may be a channel to start peace process, to have a separate peace with the Soviet Union.
You have been very active in peacekeeping as a country, as a nation. That's something you share with the Holy See, would you say?
Oh, yes, indeed. We actually learned not only during the World War II, but we learned also later on that this security in Europe, in the process on Security Conference of Europe, we promoted similar kind of goals when the conference was paired. 1972 till 1975. And I think that period of time very much taught the Finnish diplomacy through the Vatican. The dialogue, meaning of dialogue, meaning of also human rights. We opened the conference for human rights issues, and this played a role when we think in terms of the collapse of the totalitarian regimes. This process certainly pushed things forward to strengthen democracy and human rights in Europe.
Also among the guests of honour I spoke to at this event were the leaders of the three official religions in Finland, the majority evangelical Lutheran, the Orthodox and the Catholic. As I discovered, all pragmatically skilled at finding common ground, this nation's Christian heritage lingers on. But why don't we begin by listening to the leader of the majority church, the Lutheran Archbishop Kari Markkinen.
This is, of course, this is special because here are the church traditions, Finnish church traditions together visiting Rome. And at the same time, this is the state of Finland is present so strongly in this occasion. For me as well, it means that the state relations and the ecumenical relations are not separated, but they work together. And of course, we have this tradition of each year in January, we visit Rome in St. Henry's Day, the Catholic bishop from Finland and one Lutheran bishop from Finland, and sometimes also an Orthodox bishop. That's a tradition which is very important for our relations between Catholics and Lutherans in Finland and international ecumenical movement as well.
A continuity then stemming from the evangelizing mission of St. Henry, the Catholic bishop from England, who's said to have brought Christianity here from the West. One who lived over eight centuries before the time of the father of the Finnish Reformation, Mikael Agricola. And indeed a saint, mentioned by Blessed John Paul II in 1989 during his apostolic visit to Finland, as having sown the seeds of faith and given witness to his love for Christ by shedding his blood. A saint whose memory is still very much alive in Turku's medieval cathedral today, where the first Finnish-born Catholic bishop of Helsinki since the Reformation was recently consecrated bishop. He too was present in Villa Lante for celebrations on this occasion. His name, Bishop Teemu Sippo. A convert to the Catholic Church, he told me he felt the weight of 500 years of history on his shoulders, but broadened the conversation on to explaining how half of the Catholics in Finland are immigrants from over 80 countries across the world. You are the first native-born bishop since the Reformation, is that correct?
Yes, since 500 years.
500 years. Do you feel the weight on your shoulders?
A little, yes.
Tell me, Catholics are a minority. Are they mainly Finnish or they come from Poland or other countries?
Mainly, actually, from elsewhere. We have over 50% there immigrants in the church, and about 40% there Finnish. These immigrants, they have around 80 different nationalities, so that they are from all over the world. And it is a sign that the Catholic Church is everywhere.
Were you born a Catholic?
No, I converted as I was 18 years old.
You were a Lutheran?
Yes, I was Lutheran, yeah.
And you were consecrated as bishop in the cathedral in Turku. Can you share your emotions? That is a very symbolic moment, no?
Yes, it was.
An ecumenical moment, too.
Yeah, of course. It is an old Catholic cathedral from the Middle Ages, and that was my main point. As I asked the Archbishop of Turku if it could be possible to be consecrated in the cathedral. Of course, now it is Lutheran, and therefore it was also a very important ecumenical event. Many people showed that they are glad that there's now a Finnish-born bishop. It was a big joy for many.
What does it mean to you to travel together with the other two bishops of the official religions?
We are very glad to do that. Somehow we come together very well.
Can you comment on this occasion? What does it mean to you?
It means that for the Finnish state, the Catholic Church is important. They want to collaborate or cooperate with the Catholic Church in many fields, and especially maybe for the peace and justice and in these things. But of course it is important for the Catholic Church in Finland, because church is still very small, and we live in a diaspora situation. So for us also Rome is important, maybe more important than for those churches which are big and make a majority. For the small church, Rome is always important.
The solemnity of this occasion was also highlighted by the leader of the other official church in this nation which borders with Russia, the Orthodox, in the person of Archbishop Leo of Karelia in all Finland, whose church, despite the geographical closeness to Russia, belongs to the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople. He's a church leader keen to broaden ecumenical boundaries. Belong to the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, despite being so close to Russia.
Yes, our mother church is, of course, Russian Orthodox Church, but we are members of Constantinople, Patriarchate of Constantinople. We had autonomous status from Russian Church from beginning 1921, but from 1923 we can say other than Constantinople. Maybe some political reasons and so on, you can understand, but we have very good relations with Russian Orthodox Church also today.
What is the meaning of your coming to Rome with the head of the Lutheran Church and the head of the Catholic Church?
I will tell you that we have been 2 years ago in Constantinople. McKinnon and Temosipo, they had never been there, but now they have been there once with me. And last week we visited Moscow and we met Patriarch Kirill there.
All three of you?
Yes. And also that visit to Moscow was first to both of those other bishops. And now we are here, and I'm sure that we are going together. I don't know, but maybe we can go to Mount Athos or Mount Sinai or something.
An openness, then, in ecumenical relations, distant in time from that earlier historical mood of suspicion between the three churches. Finland may be a harsh land, but it's certainly a nation come in from the cold. No need for icebreakers to celebrate 70 years of diplomatic relations between Finland and the Holy See, at both the state and ecumenical level. To quote from Blessed John Paul II once again when he visited Helsinki, "Drawn together by the rigours of a harsh climate, you have forged a close-knit society which cherishes the ideals of peace, justice and harmony." My thanks go to my guests on this programme, their Ambassador of Finland to the Holy See, the leaders of the three official religions of the nation, the Evangelical Lutheran Archbishop Kari Mäkinen, the head of the Orthodox Church, Archbishop Leo of Karelia and all Finland, and the Catholic Bishop of Helsinki, Teemu Sippo. Meanwhile, time to follow up on last week's reflection by renowned theologian and author, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, focusing on the Second Vatican Council.
My dear friends, I told you a story about Archbishop Michael Ramsay and how he led me to feel that the richest legacy of Vatican II would be Jesus himself. In fact, the Council issued no specific document about Jesus Christ, but his presence pervades all 16 texts. Let me single out three of these documents: the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, the Dogmatic Constitution on Divine Revelation, and the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. All three documents have wonderful, lovely things to say about Jesus. The Constitution on the Liturgy, for instance, expected that actively sharing in the Mass should set the faithful aflame with Christ's love. His life-giving presence is at its most intense in the Eucharist, but it's also to be experienced when any of the sacraments is celebrated, when the Scriptures are proclaimed, and whenever the community prays and sings together in the name of Jesus. When we count our conciliar blessings, one of the first should be this rich and wonderful sense of the manifold presence of Christ in the public worship of the Church. Although liturgy is primarily concerned with worshipping God, it is, or should also be, the central moment when God speaks to his people, the moment when Christ is still proclaiming his gospel. The Council treasured the liturgy of the word and hoped that its climax, the homily, would convey the intense power of the risen Christ and the transforming grace of his good news. Sadly, homilies are still sometimes only a whimper rather than a bang. They can become tedious exercises in moralizing, little more than the exhortation, "Be good, be kind, and God save the Queen." But where a homily breaks open the words of Scripture and lets Christ speak to the questions, fears, and hopes of people, the powerful presence of the Lord comes through. That presence focuses and fosters our commitment to him, to one another, and to the world. Then a Christ-centered life entails constantly mulling over the Scriptures. That's the message of the closing chapter of the Constitution on Divine Revelation. This chapter dreams of a church living the Bible at every level of her existence, a church constantly learning to know Jesus Christ in a fresh and deep way through frequent reading of the Scriptures. Day by day, a Christ-centered life is nourished by the Scriptures, that divine reading, Lectio Divina, that Pope Benedict has been keen to emphasize. Then in the third millennium, the human family finds its future existence threatened in all kinds of ways. More than ever, it needs the message of Christ expressed through Vatican II's Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. He is the light of the whole world, the full and final key to what human life is ultimately about. This document from the Council never loses sight of the Son of God, who has truly become one of us. He worked with human hands, thought with a human mind, and loved with a human heart. What the Council wanted in its last and longest document, the Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, was to spread a life-transforming experience of Jesus. One might sum up its deepest message by applying some words from a former general of the Jesuit order, the saintly Father Pedro Arrupe, himself a participant in the Council. All in love with Jesus, stay in love with Jesus, and that will decide everything. With great gratitude, we remember Vatican II and its great legacy, the call to live a more Christ-centered life.
Finally, on a different note, I'd like to bring you an archive programme taken from the series The Latin Lover, recorded in the years when my guest speaker, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, worked as papal Latinist here in the Vatican. I've picked this particular programme to mark the feast day of John Fisher and Thomas More, which falls each year on the 22nd of June. Okay. You know what I found? I found something that maybe you're interested in.
John Fisher. Oh, Lord. West, that's another one.
West Monasterian, which means Westminster, I guess.
Yeah, West Monasteriensis.
The canonization of
the Blessed Martyrs, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and Thomas More, the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum
Cardinalis
Johannes Fisher.
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know.
I don't know how they did it. These are old Roman names.
Maybe Rochester was an old Roman.
Yeah, certainly.
And Thomas More, Tomae.
Tomae More, whether more. Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
Yeah, this is, when they're asking a question.
So
and because the doubt is in the next line with the with these letters here. Whether a commission should be assigned of resuming the case at hand and for the effect about which we are talking. That's the doubt. Mm-hmm. That it should be undertake once again the case of canonization of these people. And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, yes, of course, but
This was before the founding of our radio station, because this
1930
happened in June 1930.
I see.
The 18th of June 1930.
Very good. Wonderful.
So, inter beatos martyris Angliae, qua glorioso, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula appellabatur.
Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints, with a glorious title.
Was it called the Island of the Saints?
Oh, I don't know. That's what he says. You better look into it. That's not my kind of business. Two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
Stelle,
certainly.
Refulgent. Due lustrus vire tamquam stelle
refulgent. Oh, is that good? Okay, among all the blessed martyrs of England, you see, one in the high degree of ecclesiastical hierarchy, because he was a bishop, and constituted in the Episcopal order, John Cardinal Fisher, Bishop of the people of Rochester.
Let's move down here. I suppose Cardinal wrote this, no? Someone called Cardinal Laurenti.
Heaven's sakes.
But would this have been written in Latin by the cardinal's office, or would there be in those days? You would have been out of a job.
I mean, we do these things every day.
Do you?
I was doing the canonization of, I don't know what, Spanish martyrs in the Civil War, So, I mean, these are flunkies, secretaries who do this stuff.
You're a flunky. You describe yourself as a flunky.
Well, yeah, I mean, we just blah, 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 blah.
What's a flunky in Latin?
Oh, it's nequam. A worthless guy is a flunky. It's nequam.
It's a strange thing, because at Vatican Radio, we don't have a Latin program, but we have an Esperanto program.
Well, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You used to have a Latin program. Some Jesuit, and he, a Slovenian Jesuit, and then he died, and who do you call it, some other Jesuit, said, it's the end of Latin. Well, anyway.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus, in
1480. And educated in Oxford. Pious. Oxonii educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so on and so on. Praebat fidelibus super abbot Chelsea. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus viractus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so on.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII.
Daughters go out into the water and say, "Oh, salve me, Rex." And they address Henry VIII in Latin. when he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge?
Up
the Thames, rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit in vicula sua, Henricus Rex.
In fact, in this,
beautiful.
In this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph here, they speak about Henry VIII. Paolo post Rex Henricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was irritas et sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who, while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tentaverat had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. You see the whole story there. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony, so forth and so on, de facit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem defecit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erexit. And he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum, a standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub.
Well, we write the same thing today.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religion bonus abusu militare coagit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abuse of his royal power. Ooh, they're glorious.
They seem to dedicate more time to Thomas More than John Fisher.
Although, actually, Fisher was the most educated man around. Everyone knows that.
There's lots here in italics.
Well, these are all quotes. Well, that's very good and beautiful. Oh, I have to save these things. I mean, I just kind of never thought of doing this. And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. Where is it? Affirmative.
If affirmative seo signanda.
Name me that a commission should be designated of the resumption of the case, if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so forth and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th in 1930.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.